part two of the selected talks and meditations of Rudolf Steiner called Staying Connected, How to Continue Your Relationships with Those Who Have Died. Part two is called Practice. Lecture 7, the introduction. Behind the world of sense perceptions lies the elemental or imaginal world. This world can be known only through imaginations or images. Ordinary consciousness is largely unaware of that world. Nevertheless, unconsciously, imaginations, impressions we receive from the elemental world, are perpetually flowing into us. In a sense, they are more important than our sense perceptions because they become part of our whole etheric organism. We receive imaginations from all earthly realms, mineral, plant, and animal, but above all from the interhuman realm. Our life with others is a shifting sea of exchanged images. Often we experience these as antipathy or sympathy, a sympathy that can become undying love. We receive such images all the time and carry them with us. They give warmth to our lives, and as we become more interested in our fellow human beings, we gain more warmth, and the images that flow between us become more intense. Thereby we become related to the elemental world, to a multitude of elemental beings, and above all to our own etheric counterpart. When we pass through the gate of death, we bear our elemental, imaginal being with us. In a sense, we become that being. For this reason, the first impression we receive from a soul who has died arises through images. After that, our etheric being is absorbed by its etheric counterpart and becomes the quote-unquote instrument of the evolving individuality whom we have known and loved and with whom we must continue to work. Many of the ways the dead are present to those on earth are connected to this elemental or etheric being. The interplay of imaginations continues. If we have known the person and can continue our interest and love, the interplay can continue. Quote, interest and love, unquote, mean that we continue to carry something of the departed one within us. If we have not known them, then with difficulty a substitute or aid may be found, a handwriting sample, for instance, or empathy with the grief of those left behind. However difficult this might be, unconsciously, imaginations from the dead work continuously, in many ways into the lives of the living, for instance, in bringing people together. But there is a still more intimate way of living together with the dead. Besides the elemental world, we live in the soul or astral world as well. Ordinarily, we are in this world only while we are asleep, when the I and astral body are outside the physical realm, and we encounter astral beings, soul beings in the soul world. These include the soul beings of the dead. Our interchange with them takes place not through imaginations, but through inspirations. We can train ourselves to take such inspirations into our consciousness. We take into our own being some part of the being who wishes to inspire us. To accomplish this, we must be able to transform ourselves into the other, and to do this we must purify ourselves of all egotism. The dead who want to work into the earth cannot work through our egotism, that is, through sympathy and antipathy, love and hate, driven by our egotism. They see us as we are on earth. They see our love and hate as luciferic and daimonic. Because of this, a great love arises in the dead for the living. For us to reciprocate, we must become free of our personal feelings of sympathy and antipathy, otherwise the dead cannot enter our souls. There is, of course, yet another way we are connected with the dead, through intuitions, eye to eye. The lecture is called How the Dead Influence the Living, given in Bern, November 9th, 1916. A goal of spiritual scientific practice is to form ideas of how we as human beings live with the spiritual worlds. We know that we are connected with the physical world through the experiences and perceptions of our physical bodies, and we strive to understand how we are connected with the spiritual worlds. I may as well start our reflections today with what we already know from all that has come before our souls during these last years. First, we have the world of our sense perceptions, the world to which we direct our impulses of will, our actions. The physical body mediates this. Immediately behind this world of sense perception lies the next world, the elemental world. What we call it does not matter, and we could also give it other names, but we will gain a clear idea of the supersensible worlds only if we enter to some extent into some of their characteristics and try to recognize what they are for us as human beings. The whole of our earthly life between birth and death, and also our next life, which takes place between death and a new birth, depends on our coexistence with the various worlds spread out around us. What we are calling the elemental world is the world that can be seen only by what we know as imaginations. Thus we may also call the elemental world the imaginal world. In ordinary human life, under ordinary circumstances, we cannot lift our imaginal perceptions, our perceptions of the elemental world, into consciousness. This does not mean that the imaginations are not there, or that at any given moment of our sleeping or waking life we are not in relation with the elemental world and receiving imaginations from it. On the contrary, imaginations perpetually ebb and flow within us. Though we are unaware of it, we constantly receive impressions from the elemental world. Just as we have sensations of color, light, and sound when we open our eyes and ears to the outer world, we also receive continuous impressions from the elemental world that produce imaginations in our etheric body. Imaginations differ from ordinary thoughts. In ordinary, everyday human thoughts, only the head participates as the instrument of their processing and experience. In imaginations, however, we participate with almost the whole of our organism, our etheric organism. Imaginations take place all the time in our etheric organism, but they rise into consciousness only for trained occult cognition. We may therefore refer to them as unconscious imaginations. However, even though they do not enter our consciousness directly in everyday life, they are not therefore meaningless for us. On the contrary, they are far more important for our life as a whole than our sense perceptions, for we are united far more intensely and intimately with our imaginations than with our sense perceptions. As physical human beings, we receive few imaginations from the mineral kingdom. We receive more through all that we develop by living with the plant and animal worlds, but the greater part by far of what lives as imaginations in our etheric body is due to our relations with our fellow human beings, and all that these relations entail for our life as a whole. In fact, our whole relation with our fellow human beings, our whole attitude toward them, is based fundamentally on imaginations. Imaginations always result from the way we meet another human being. Although, as I said, they do not appear as imaginations to ordinary consciousness, they nevertheless make themselves felt in the sympathies and antipathies that play such an overwhelming part in our life. As human beings, we develop sympathies and antipathies, to a greater or lesser degree, with all that approaches us in this world. We have vague, undefined feelings, slight inclinations or disinclinations. Sometimes our sympathies grow into friendship and love, love that can be so heightened that we think we can no longer live without this or that human being. All this is due to imaginations that are perpetually called forth in our etheric body by our life with our fellow human beings. In fact, we always carry with us in life something that cannot quite be called memory, for it is far more real than memory. We bear within us, as it were, heightened memories or imaginations that we have received from all the impressions of the human beings we have ever encountered, and we continue to receive these all the time. We bear them within us. In fact, they make up a goodly portion of what we call our inner life, not the predominant life that lives in clear, well-defined memories, but the inner life that makes itself felt in our prevailing mood and feeling, and above all in our outlook on the world itself, our own life in the world. We would pass the world around us coldly by and would live indifferently with our contemporary world if we did not unfold this imaginal life by living together with other beings and, above all, with other human beings. We must look upon what makes itself felt here, our soul's interest in the surrounding world, as belonging particularly to the elemental world and especially to our own etheric body. This interest is inherent in the forces of our etheric body, and it makes itself felt as interest. Sometimes we feel ourselves immediately caught and interested, such interest, often woven from the very first moment between one human being and another, is due to definite relationships that arise between the one etheric human being and the other, bringing about the play of imaginations between them. We live with these imaginations and with our own resulting sympathies, whose effect and intensity we are often largely unaware of, or aware of only in the vaguest way. Indeed, when our everyday life is not wide awake, but runs along more or less dully, we often fail to observe them at all. Thereby we belong to the elemental world, for our etheric bodies derive from the elemental world. The etheric body is our instrument of communication with the elemental world. Through it we weave relationships not only with other etheric bodies that belong to physical beings, but also with spiritual beings that have an elemental character. Such, quote, beings of an elemental character, unquote, are precisely those able to call forth conscious or unconscious imaginations in us. Human beings are perpetually related to a multitude of elemental beings, and this differentiates one human being from another. Each has several relationships. One human being to a given set of elemental beings, another to another set of elemental beings. Moreover, the relations of one human being to certain elemental beings may sometimes coincide with the relations of another to the same beings. However, it must be observed in this connection that while we are always, in a manner of speaking, related to a large number of elemental beings, we have relations of special intensity only with one elemental being, who is, in essence, the counterpart of our own etheric body. Our own etheric body is intimately related to one particular etheric being. Just as what we call our etheric body develops its own relations from birth until death to the physical world inasmuch as it is inserted in a physical body, so does this etheric entity, the counterpart or counterpole, as it were, of our own etheric body, enable us to have relations to the whole of the elemental world, the whole surrounding cosmic elemental world. Hence we may be said to look out upon an elemental world to which we ourselves belong by virtue of our etheric body, and with which we stand in manifold relations, specific relationships to particular elemental beings. In the elemental world, we meet beings who are truly no less real than human beings or animals in the physical world, beings who never come to incarnation, however, but only to, quote, etherization, unquote, so to speak, for their densest corporeality is ethereal. Just as we go about among physical people in this world, so do we constantly go about among such elemental beings, some of whom are more remote and, in their turn, related to other people. Some of these elemental beings, however, are more closely related to us, and one among them relates to each of us most closely of all, and acts as our organ of communication with the entire cosmic elemental world. Now, in the time immediately following our passage through the gate of death, when for a few days we still bear our etheric body, we ourselves become precisely such a being as these elemental beings are. In a manner of speaking, we ourselves become an elemental being. I have often described this process of the passage through the gate of death, but the more exactly we study it, the clearer the imaginations it provides. For the impressions we receive immediately after the passage of a human being through the gate of death always consist in and make themselves felt as imaginations. Observing the process more exactly, we find that there is a certain mutual interplay immediately after death between our own etheric body and its etheric counterpart. The fact that our etheric body is taken from us a few days after death is due mainly to its being attracted, drawn in, as it were, by this etheric counterpart. Henceforth it becomes one with its etheric counterpart. A few days after death we lay aside our etheric body. We hand it over, as it were, to our own etheric counterpart. Our etheric body is taken from us by our own cosmic prototype, or image, and as a result special relations now emerge between what is thus taken from us and the other elemental beings with whom we have been related in any way during our life. We might describe it thus. A kind of mutual relation now arises between what our own etheric body has become, united as it is now with its counterpart or counter-image, and the other elemental beings who accompany us from birth until death. We might compare this to the relation of a sun to its associated planetary system. Our etheric body with its cosmic counterpart is like a kind of sun, surrounded as a kind of planetary system by other elemental beings. This mutual interplay gives rise to the forces that instill into the elemental world, rightly and in gradual evolution, all that our etheric body is able to take into that world. What we commonly refer to in abstract terms when we speak of the dissolution of the etheric body is essentially a play of forces, engendered by this sun and planetary system that we have left behind. Gradually everything that we acquired and assimilated into our etheric body in the course of our life becomes a part of the spiritual world, weaving into the forces of the spiritual world. We must be very clear on this. Every thought, every idea, every feeling we develop, however hidden it remains, is of significance for the spiritual world. For when the coherence is broken by our passage through the gate of death, all our thoughts and feelings pass with our etheric body into the spiritual world and become part and parcel of it. We do not live for nothing. What we receive into the thoughts that we make our own, into the feelings that we experience, become the fruits of our life, embodied in the cosmos. This is a truth we must receive into our whole mood and outlook, otherwise we do not conduct ourselves rightly in the spiritual scientific movement. You are not a spiritual scientist merely by knowing about certain things. You are such only if you feel yourself, by virtue of this knowledge, to exist within the spiritual world. If you know yourself quite definitely to be a part of the spiritual world. Then you will say to yourself, the thought I am now harboring is of significance for the whole universe. For at my death it will be handed over to the universe in such and such a form. After a human being has died, we may have to deal in one form or another with what is thus handed over to the universe. Many of the ways that the dead are present to those they have left behind manifest because the etheric human being, who has, of course, been laid aside by the real individuality, sends back imaginations to the living. And if those still living are sensitive enough, or if they are in some abnormal state or have prepared themselves by proper spiritual training, the influences of what is thus given over to the spiritual world by the dead, influences, that is to say, of the imaginal kind, can emerge in them in a conscious form. At the same time, after death, there is still a connection between the true human individuality and the etheric entity that has separated from it. There is a mutual interplay between them. We can observe it most clearly when, through spiritual training, we come into actual communication with this or that dead individual. A certain kind of exchange can then take place. To begin with, the dead human being conveys to the etheric body what he or she wishes to transmit to those still in the physical world. For only by the dead person's transmitting it to the etheric body, making, as it were, inscriptions in the etheric body, can we perceive it here in the physical world in terms of what we call imaginations. The moment we have imaginations of a person, the dead person's etheric body is acting as a switch or commutator, if you will pardon my use of the trivial and all too realistic term. Do not imagine that our relations to the dead need be any the less deeply felt because such an instrument is needed. People who meet us in the outer world also convey their form to us by the pictures they evoke in us through our own eyes. It is the same with this transmission through the etheric body. We perceive what the dead wish to convey to us by getting it, so to speak, through their etheric body. This body is outside the dead person, but so intimately related that it can be inscribed with what lives within that person, thus enabling us to read it in imaginations. There is, however, this condition. A spiritually trained person who wishes to connect through the etheric body in this way with a dead human being must have had some relationship with the dead person, either in the last life between birth and death or in a former incarnation. Moreover, these relationships must have affected the soul of the one who is still alive deeply enough for the imaginations to make an impression. And this can happen only if in one's heart and mind there is a definite and living interest in the dead person. Interests of heart and feeling must always mediate between the living and the dead if any exchange at all, conscious or unconscious, is to take place. We shall speak of the latter presently. Some interest of heart and feeling must be there, so that we really carry something of the dead within us. In a way, the dead person must have constituted a portion of our own soul's experience. However, one who is spiritually trained can make a certain substitute. One can, for instance, give oneself up to the impression of the handwriting or of something else where the individuality of the dead is living. This may at first seem external, but spiritual training turns it into something far more inward. However, one can do this, contact someone through their handwriting, only if one has acquired a certain practice in making contact with an individuality through the fact that he or she lives in the writing. Or again, one may establish the possibility of contact by entering with sympathy into the feelings of the physical survivors, partaking in their grief and in all the emotional interest they have in the dead person. By entering with sympathy into these real and living feelings that flow from the dead into the dear ones they have left on earth, or that remain in their inner life, a person of spiritual training can prepare his or her soul to read the imaginations. It is also true that although perceiving the imaginations from the etheric body depends on spiritual training or other special conditions, at the same time what passes unperceived by most people is nonetheless there. Therefore, we may truly say that those living in the physical world are not woven around only by the elemental forces in the form of imaginations proceeding from other human beings living with them in the physical body. For whether we know it or not, our etheric bodies are constantly played through by all the imaginations we absorb from those who stood in any kind of relation to us and who have passed through the gate of death before us. In physical life, in the physical body, we are related to the air around us. So too are we related to the whole of the elemental world, including all that is there of the dead. We shall never learn to know human life unless we gain knowledge of these relationships, although they are so intimate and fine that most people do not notice them. After all, who can deny that we do not remain always the same between birth and death? Let us look back upon our lives. However consistent we may think the course of our lives has been, we will soon notice that we have, in fact, often gone to and fro in life, or that this or that has occurred. Even if something does not immediately change the direction of our lives, which it can, of course, do, it nonetheless has the effect of enriching our lives in one way or another, in a happy direction or a painful one. Life always brings us different conditions, just as when you move to another area, your general feeling of health may be changed by the different composition of the air. These soul moods we enter in the course of our lives are due to the influences of the elemental world. They are due in no small measure to the influences that come from the dead who were formerly related to us. Many people in earthly life meet a friend or someone they become connected with in one way or another, to whom perhaps they find themselves obliged to do this or that by way of kindness or of criticism or rebuke. The fact that they were brought together required the influence of certain forces. A person who recognizes the occult connections in the world knows that when two human beings are brought together to this end or that, sometimes one and sometimes several of those who have gone through the gate of death before them are instrumental in this. Our lives do not become any less free thereby. We do not lose our freedom because we starve if we do not eat. No one who is not deliberately foolish will ask how we can be free, given that we are obliged to eat. It would be just as invalid to say that we lose our freedom because our souls constantly receive influences from the elemental world. Just as we are connected with the air around us, with warmth and cold, and with all the things that become our food, so we are also connected with what comes to us from those who have died before us. We are similarly connected with the rest of the elemental world, but above all with what comes to us from the dead. Therefore we can truly say that our work for our fellow human beings does not cease with our passage through the gate of death. Human beings remain connected to the etheric body after death, and through it send imaginations into those with whom they were connected in life. Indeed, the world we are referring to here is far more real than that we commonly call real, even if it remains unperceived in our everyday life, for very good reasons. So much, then, about the elemental world for today. Another realm that is always present in our environment, to which we ourselves belong no less than to the elemental world, is what we may call the soul world. The name does not matter. We are always connected to our waking life with the elemental world, and we are still connected indirectly with it and with our etheric body in sleep, when our eye and our astral body are outside the physical and the etheric bodies. But we are connected most directly with the higher soul world to which I now refer. However, as with the elemental world, the soul world cannot rise into our consciousness in ordinary life. We are connected with it in sleep, when our astral body is freely around us, and we are connected with it in waking life as well, although then the connection, mediated as it is by forces the physical body has drawn into itself, is no longer so direct. In this world of soul, we shall call it the soul world for the present, although medieval philosophers referred to it as the heavenly or celestial world, we find beings who are just as real as we are during our life between birth and death. In fact, these beings are even more real. However, they do not need to come to embodiment in a physical body or even in an etheric body. They live in their lowest corporeality, in what we call the astral body. We are connected constantly and intimately with a large number of these purely astral beings, both during our life and after our death. As is the case with elemental beings, we differ from one another as human beings, inasmuch as we are related to different astral beings. Here again, two people may have relationships in common with one or more astral beings, and at the same time have several relations to other astral beings. When we have laid aside our etheric body, after passing through the gate of death, we ourselves belong to the world of the astral beings. With our own individuality, we are then among the beings of the soul world. We are soul beings at that time. Beings of the soul world are our immediate environment. True, we are also still related to the content of the elemental world, inasmuch as we can kindle in it what evokes imaginations. The elemental world, however, is in a certain sense outside us, or, as one might also say, beneath us. It is something we use to communicate with the rest of the world. But we ourselves belong directly to what I have now called the world of soul, and it is with the beings of the soul world that we have our interchange. These include other human beings who have also passed through the gate of death and after a few days laid aside their etheric bodies. Just as we constantly receive influences from the elemental world, although we do not notice it, so too we constantly receive influences directly into our astral body out of the soul world I am now describing. The immediate, straightforward influences that we thus receive can appear as inspirations. Parenthesis, we have already spoken of the indirect influences via the etheric body. Parenthesis. You will understand the character of these influences from the soul world if I describe once more in a few words how it appears to those who are spiritually trained, that is, to those who are able to receive conscious inspirations from the spiritual world. It appears as follows. Spiritual researchers can bring these inspirations to consciousness only if they are able, so to speak, to take into themselves some portion of the being who wants to inspire them, some portion of the qualities of the inherent life tendency of such a being. Those who are spiritually trained to develop conscious relations with the dead, not only through the etheric body, imagination, but in this direct way, through inspiration, must bear in their souls, even more than simple interest or sympathy is able to call forth. They must, for a short while at least, be able to transform themselves, so as to receive into their own being something of the habits and character, the very human nature of the one with whom they wish to communicate. These researchers must be able to enter the one who has died to such a degree that they could take on the person's habits and do what that person could do, and in the same way. They must also be able to feel and will as he or she could. It is the could that matters, the possibility. This is to say that we must be able to live together with the dead even more intimately. For those who are spiritually trained, there are many ways of coming close to the dead, provided, of course, that the dead person permits it. However, we must realize that the beings who belong to what we are now calling the world of soul are quite differently related to the world that we are in our physical bodies. Hence there are certain quite definite conditions of exchange with such beings, including among others the dead, as long as these are still living as astral beings in their astral bodies. Here certain points deserve special attention. You see, all that we develop for our lives in the physical body are many and varied relationships to other people, parenthesis, I mean precisely those relationships that arise through earthly life, parenthesis. All this acquires quite another kind of interest for the dead. Here on earth, we develop sympathies and antipathies. We must be clear about this. The sympathies and antipathies that we develop while living in the physical body are subject to the influences of our present form of life, which we owe to the physical body and to its conditions. These sympathies and antipathies are subject to the influences of our own vanity and of our egoism. Let us not fail to realize how many of the relationships that we develop with this or that human being result from vanity or egoism, or other things that depend on our physical and earthly life in this world. We love other people or we hate them. As a rule, we actually take little notice of the true grounds of our loving and our hating, our sympathies and antipathies. In fact, often we avoid consciously noticing our sympathies and antipathies, simply because if we did so, as a rule, highly unpleasant truths would emerge. If, for instance, we followed up what was really behind our failure to love this or that human being, we would often have to ascribe so much prejudice, vanity, or other qualities to ourselves that it would frighten us. Therefore, we do not bring to full conscious clarity why we hate this person or that. And the same is often true with love. Interests, sympathies, and antipathies evolve in ways that have significance only for our everyday life. Yet it is out of all this that we act. We arrange our life according to these interests, sympathies, and antipathies. Now, it would be quite wrong to imagine that the dead can possibly have the same interest we on earth have in all the ephemeral sympathies and antipathies that arise under the influence of our physical and earthly lives. That would be utterly wrong. Truly, the dead are obliged to look at these things from quite another standpoint. Moreover, we may ask ourselves if we are not largely influenced in our estimate of our fellow human beings by these subjective feelings, by all that lies inherent in our subjective interests, our vanity, egoism, and the like. Let us not think for a moment that the dead can have any interest in such relationships between ourselves and other human beings, or in our actions arising from such interests. But we must also not imagine that the dead do not see what lives in our souls, for it really lives there, and the dead see it well enough. They share in it, too, but they see something else as well. The dead have a quite different way of judging people. The dead see people quite differently. One thing is of outstanding importance in how the dead see human beings here on earth. Let us not imagine that the dead do not have a keen living interest in the world of human beings. They certainly do, for the world of human beings belongs to the whole cosmos. Our own lives belong to the cosmos. And just as we, even in the physical world, interest ourselves in the subordinate kingdoms, so the dead interest themselves intensely in the human world and send their active impulses into it. The dead work through the living into the earthly world. We have just given an example of the way they go on working soon after their passage through the gate of death. The dead see one thing above all, and that most clearly. Suppose, for example, that they see someone here following hateful impulses, hating this person or that, and with a merely personal intensity or purpose. The dead see this. At the same time, however, depending upon the whole manner of their vision, and all that they are then able to know, they will observe quite clearly the part that Ahriman is playing in this case. The dead see how Ahriman impels us to hatred. The dead actually see Ahriman working upon the human being. On the other hand, if a person on earth is vain, the dead see Lucifer at work. That is the essential point. It is in connection with the world of Ahriman and Lucifer that the dead see the human beings who are here on earth. Consequently, what generally colors our judgment of people is quite eliminated for the dead. We see this or that human being whom in one sense or another we must condemn. Whatever we find blameworthy, we ascribe to the human being. The dead do not ascribe it directly to the human being. They see how the person is misled by Lucifer or Ahriman. This brings about a toning down, so to speak, of the sharply differentiated feelings that in our physical and earthly life we generally extend toward this or that human being. To a far greater extent than on earth, a kind of universal human love arises in the dead. This does not mean that the dead cannot criticize, that is to say, that they cannot rightly see what is evil in evil. They see it well enough, but they are able to refer it to its origin, to its real inner connections. What I have described here is not without its consequences, for it means that those with esoteric training cannot consciously come near one who is dead unless they truly free themselves from feelings of personal sympathy or antipathy toward individuals. Such researchers must not allow themselves to be dependent in their souls on personal feelings of sympathy or antipathy. You need only imagine it for a moment. Suppose that a trained clairvoyant was about to approach a dead human being, whoever that might be, so that the inspirations sent by the dead might find their way into the researcher's consciousness. Suppose, moreover, that the researcher on earth was pursuing another human being with a quite special hatred, hatred having its origin only in personal relationships. Then truly, as our hand avoids fire, so would the dead avoid such a person who is capable of hatred for personal reasons. Such a person cannot approach the dead, for hatred works on the dead like fire. To come into conscious relation with the dead, we must be able to make ourselves like them, independent, in a sense, of personal sympathies and antipathies. Thus you will understand what I now have to say. Bear in mind this whole relation of the dead to the living in so far as it rests on inspirations. Remember that the inspirations are always there, even if they pass unnoticed. They are perpetually living in the human astral body, so that human beings on earth have relations with the dead in this direct way. Now, after all we have said, you will understand that these relationships depend on our whole mood and spirit in our lives here on earth. if our attitude to other people is hostile, if we are without interest or sympathy for our contemporaries, above all, if we do not have an unprejudiced interest in our fellows, then the dead cannot approach us as they long to do. They cannot properly transplant themselves into our souls, or if they must do so, it is made difficult for them in one way or another, and they can do it only with great suffering and pain. All in all, the living together of the dead with the living is complicated. Thus we continue to work when we pass through the gate of death, even directly, inasmuch as after death we inspire those who are living on the physical plane. And this is absolutely true. Especially in their inner habits and qualities, the way they think, feel, and develop inclinations, those living on earth at any given time are dependent to a great extent on those who have died and passed from the earth before them, those who were related to them during life or to whom they themselves established a relation even after death, which may sometimes happen, though it is not so easy. A certain part of the ordering of the world and of all of human progress depends on this working of the dead into the life of earthly human beings, inspiring them. Moreover, in their instinctive life, people have an inkling that this is so, and that it must be so. We can observe this if we consider for a moment ways of life that were formerly very widespread and are now dying out, because humanity goes on to new forms of life in the course of evolution. In times gone by, when, generally speaking, human beings divined far more of the reality of spiritual worlds, they were more deeply aware of what is necessary for life as a whole. They knew that the living need the dead, need to receive into their habits and customs the impulses from the dead. What, then, did they do? You need only think of former times when it was generally customary for a father to take care that his son should inherit and carry on his business, so that the son went on working in the same sphere. Then, when the father was long dead, a bond of communication was created through the physical world itself, because the son remained in the same channels of life. The son's activity and life work being akin to his father's, the father was able to work on in him. Many things in life were based on this principle, and if whole classes of society attached great value to the inheritance of this or that property within the class or within its several families, it was due to their divining this necessity. The life habits of those who live earlier must enter into the life habits of those who live later, but only when these life habits are so far ripened that they come forth after one has passed through the gate of death, for it is only then that they become mature. These things are coming to an end, as you know. Such is the progress of the human race. We can already see a time when these inheritances, these conservative conditions, will no longer play a part. The physical bonds will no longer be there in the same way. To compensate for this, it is all the more necessary that people receive detailed spiritual scientific knowledge that will lift the whole matter into their consciousness. Then they will be able to consciously connect their life with the life habits of former times, which we have to reckon with in order for life to go forward with continuity. Since the beginning of the fifth post-Atlantean period, we have been living in a time of transition. During this period, a more or less chaotic state has intervened. But the conditions will again arise when, through recognition of spiritual scientific truths, people will connect their life and work in a far more conscious way with what has gone before them. Unconsciously, merely instinctively, they used to do so, of that there can be no doubt. But even what remains instinctive to this day must be transmuted into consciousness. Instinctively, for instance, people still teach like this, only we do not observe it. Those who study history from a spiritual perspective will soon notice it, if only they pay attention to the facts and not to the dreadful abstractions that prevail nowadays in the so-called humanistic branches of scholarship. If we look at the facts, we can easily see that what is taught in a given epoch bears a certain character, only because people attach themselves unconsciously, instinctively, to what the dead pour down into the present. Once you learn to truly study the educational ideas that are propounded in any given age by the leading spirits in education, not the charlatans, but the true educators, you will soon see how these ideas have their origins in the ingrained habits of those who have already died, who have recently died. This is a far more intimate living together, for what affects the human astral body enters far more into one's inner life than what affects the etheric body. The communion that the dead themselves as individualities can enjoy with people on earth is far more intimate than what the etheric bodies have, or, for that matter, any other elemental beings. Hence you will see how one epoch in the life of humanity is always conditioned by the one that preceded it, The preceding time always goes on living in the time that follows. In reality, strange though it may sound, it is only after our death that we become truly ripe enough to influence other people. I mean to influence them directly, working right into their inner being. To impress our own habits on anyone who is of age, quotes, spiritually speaking, not in the legal sense, is the very thing we should not do while we are on earth. Yet it is right, and in accordance with the conditions of progressive human evolution, that we do so after we have passed through the gate of death. Besides all the things that comprise the progress of karma and the general laws of incarnation, these influences occur. If you ask for the occult reasons why people are doing one thing or another this year, not in all cases, but certainly in many, you'll find that they are doing so because impulses are flowing down to them from those who died 20 or 30 years ago, or even earlier. These are the hidden connections, the real concrete connections, between the physical and the spiritual world. It is not only for ourselves that something ripens and matures in what we carry with us through the gate of death. It is not only for ourselves, but for the world at large. And it is only from a given moment that it becomes truly ripe to work upon others. Then, however, it becomes riper and riper. I beg you to observe that I am not speaking of externals here, but of inner spiritual workings. A person may remember the habits of a dead father or grandfather and repeat them out of memory on the physical plane. That is not what I mean. That is a different matter. I mean the inspired influences, imperceptible to ordinary consciousness, that make themselves felt in our habits, in our most intimate character. Much in our life depends on our finding ourselves obliged here or there to free ourselves from the influences, even the well-meant ones, coming to us from the dead. Indeed, we gain much of our inner freedom by having to liberate ourselves in this way, in one direction or another. Inner soul conflicts, which a person is often unaware of, will grow intelligible to us when we view them in the light of spiritual knowledge of this kind. To use a trite expression, we may say that the past is rumbling on, the souls of the past go rumbling on in our own inner lives. These things are facts, the truths which we look into with spiritual vision. Unfortunately, people have a peculiar relation to these truths, especially in modern life. It was not always so. Anyone who can study history in a spiritual way will know this. Today people are afraid of these truths. They are afraid to face them. They have a nameless fear, not indeed conscious, but unconscious. Unconsciously, they are afraid to recognize the mysterious connections between soul and soul, not only in this world, but between here and the other world. It is this unconscious fear that holds people back in the outer world, and this is a part of what holds them back, instinctively, from spiritual science. They are afraid of knowing reality. They are unaware of how, by their unwillingness to know reality, they are disturbing and confusing the whole course of world evolution, and with it, needless to say, the life that will have to be lived through between death and a new birth when these conditions must be seen. Everything that evolves continuously ripens and matures. Therefore, what lives in us does not stop short at inspiration, but becomes intuition, in the true sense, as I use the word in How to Know Higher Worlds, which is still more mature. Now, intuition is only possible for a being that has a quote-unquote spirit body, to use this paradoxical expression. To work intuitively upon other beings, and among others, upon those who are still incarnated here in the physical life, human beings must first have laid aside the astral body. That is to say, they must belong entirely to the spiritual world. That will happen only decades after death, as we know. But at that point, one can work down on other people through intuition, no longer merely through inspiration, as I described it just now. Not until then does the person who has passed through the gate of death as an I work in the spiritual world, in a purely spiritual way, into other I's. Before reaching this stage, the dead worked by inspiration into the astral body, or through the etheric body, into the human etheric body, imagination. But those who have been dead for decades can also work directly as an I, although at the same time they can still work through the other vehicles as described above. At this stage, the human individuality grows sufficiently ripe to enter not just into people's habits, but even into their views and ideas of life. To modern feeling, full of prejudice as it is, this may be an unpleasant truth, doubtless very unpleasant. Nonetheless, it is true. Our views and ideas, originating as they do in our I, are under constant influences from those long dead. Those who are long dead live in our way of looking at and conceiving of life. By this very means the continuity of evolution is preserved out of the spiritual world. It is a necessity, for otherwise the thread of people's ideas would constantly be broken. Forgive me if I insert something personal at this point. I do so, may I say, for thoroughly objective reasons. For such a truth as this can only be made intelligible by concrete examples. We really ought not bring forward our own personal opinions as views or ideas, however sincerely gained. Therefore, those who stand with full sincerity on the true ground of occultism, who are experienced in the premises of spiritual science, will not impose their own opinions on the world. On the contrary, such people will do all they can to avoid imposing their own opinions directly. For the opinions and the outlook one acquires under the influence of a personal way of feeling should not begin to work until 30 or 40 years after one's death. Then it will work in this way. It will enter people's souls along the same paths that the impulses of the time spirits or archai do. Only then has it become so mature that it can work in harmony with the objective course of things. Those who stand on the true ground of occultism must therefore avoid making personal proselytes, must avoid setting out to gain followers for their own personal views, as is the general custom nowadays. No sooner do people get an opinion of their own than they hasten to make propaganda for it. That is what a real practicing spiritual scientist cannot possibly want to do. Let me now introduce the personal matter I mentioned. It was not chance, but something essential in my life, that led me to begin by writing and communicating to the world not my own views, but Goethe's. Goethe was the first thing I wrote about. At first I wrote entirely out of the spirit and sense of Goethe's world view. I did not take my start from any living person, for even if that living person were myself, it could not possibly justify my teaching spiritual science in the comprehensive way I try to do. Placing my work like this into the objective course of world evolution was a necessary link in the chain. Therefore I did not write my own theory of knowledge, but Goethe's, a theory of knowledge implicit in Goethe's world view. And I continued for some time in the same vein. Thus you see how human development proceeds. What we attain on earth ripens not only for the sake of our own lives as we advance on the paths of karma, it also ripens for the sake of the world. And so we continue to work for the world. After a certain time we become ripe to send imaginations into the habits of human beings. Then, after a further time, inspirations. And only after a longer time has elapsed do we grow ready and mature enough to send intuitions into the most intimate part of people's lives, into their views and ideas. Let us not imagine that our views and ideas of life grow out of nothing, or that they arise anew in every age. They grow from the soil in which our own soul is rooted, and this soil is in truth identical with the sphere of activity of human beings who died long ago. With this knowledge, I believe human life will receive the enrichment that it needs in accordance with the character and sense of our age and of the immediate future. Many old customs have grown rotten to the core. The new must be developed. But we cannot enter a new life without the impulses that grow in us through spiritual science. What matters are the feelings toward the world in its entirety and all the other beings of the world that we acquire through spiritual science. The mood of our lives will grow different through spiritual science. Through spiritual science, the supersensible worlds in which we always live become alive for us. We are, and always have been, living in them. The end of Lecture 7.